We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
By Jewish extremists for attacks on Arab property in response to actions by the Israeli government, such as the recent demolition of three homes in an illegal West Bank settlement. Police said they had arrested several suspects but did not give details. Angry residents of the area began marching to a nearby Jewish town. Police said they threw rocks and burned tires. Police responded with tear gas and stun grenades. For NPR News, I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Northern Pennsylvania residents displaced by flooding say they're having a tough time finding temporary housing because workers drilling for natural gas have taken nearly all of it. Flood victims say when they can find housing, they generally cannot afford it. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Reputation.com, with tools to monitor and protect the online reputations of doctors, lawyers, and business professionals. Learn more at Reputation.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
On October 20th at 7 a.m., our Fall Pledge Drive begins with a Power Hour. You can help make this a success with a contribution of $25, $50, or $75 now to the Member Match Fund. We'll use your gift to challenge others to give. Mail a check to WILL, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, 61801. Help fuel the service that brings you in-depth news and provocative music and performance all year long.
Good morning and welcome to Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives. So as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls.
Well, this is Steve Shoemaker. We're talking on Focus today with Edward E. Curtis IV from Indianapolis about his new book, Muslims in America, A Short History. Welcome, Professor Curtis.
Thanks so much, Steve.
It's good to have you on the air. I enjoyed reading your book very much. I think it's going to be very helpful to all sorts of individuals and groups who may choose to study it. I noticed that it was listed among the top 100 books of last year by Publishers Weekly. That's quite an honor.
Yeah, I was really pleased by that, especially since contemporary affairs oftentimes overshadow anything that you'd like to, anything historical. And, you know, in order to get past some of the of common stereotypes about Muslims and in the United States, and to find new ways of thinking about the place of Muslims in American society, I really do think we have to go back into our past and tell a new story about who we have been as an American people.
You mentioned in your very helpful chronology that's part of this short but packed book that
yeah.
That there were Muslims in America in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, long before there was even since 1776 this was a country. How difficult is it to find all that out?
Well, it's extremely difficult in some cases because, of course, many of the Muslims who were brought here as slaves, for example, were illiterate. Their records were not kept. We have to look at slave manifests. We have to look at names. We have to figure out where they came from, what part, whether or not that region in West Africa was Islamized at the time. We look at court cases. In some cases, in Latin America, where the population of Muslims was much higher than the population of Muslims in North America, it's easier. Because, for example, in the 1800s, we know that there was a great slave revolt in Bahia, Brazil, and the slaves actually communicated with each other and coordinated the revolt by writing Arabic notes to one another. And so that the Portuguese-speaking secret
language.
Yes, exactly. So that the slave masters couldn't read it, you know, because they were Portuguese speakers.
Amazing. When you and other historians, your field I know is religion, but to have written this book, you've had to do both, of course. When you and other historians and people in the study of religion have looked back at this record, you found some fascinating things, and your book reproduces some of the original source documents that are just fascinating, that were written in Arabic. Early sort of mini biographies of some of these slaves.
That's right. I mean, and probably the most famous autobiographical statement is that by Omar ibn Sayyid, who was a Muslim slave from West Africa, lived in North Carolina. We still have several of his manuscripts in the documentary record, and just a couple years ago, a full-length feature documentary was released about him, and he was affectionately called then and is now by his documentary filmmakers the Prince of Slaves, because he did come from a noble family from West Africa.
When you have given your many lectures around this country and around the world, really, about the origins of Islam in America, are people just always surprised to find out how early Muslims were here?
I think generally, I mean, honestly, one of the things that happens when I give this lecture is that the Q&A is often dominated by questions, this is in a general audience format,
sure.
About terrorism, about domestic terrorism, about U.S. foreign relations with Muslim-majority countries. So even when I spend 30 to 50 minutes talking about Muslims before 1980, say, it's still the Q&A is oftentimes dominated by those contemporary concerns. I honestly don't know whether the message is getting through. I know that in African America, the message is getting through because, you know, you don't have to look very far to see, for example, in Alex Haley's famous Roots, you know, a 1976 book, it acknowledges the Muslim past of African Americans. Of course, the majority of African Americans do not come from a Muslim religious background, but since they trace their roots to West Africa, it's awfully hard to separate out indigenous religions from Islam, because in West Africa, oftentimes, especially in villages, you would see a combining of these various elements in people's religious lives. So in Black America, I think, you know, there is a greater willingness and interest in acknowledging this this part of the American past, but still I'm having trouble in some ways getting through in other spaces and places.
On Focus today, we're talking with Edward Curtis from Indianapolis, where he's a professor at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, or with the acronym IUPUI, which is becoming more and more well-known, where he teaches courses on African-American religious history and Islamic studies, religion and racism, modern Middle East, among other topics. He is the He's in the Millennium Chair of the Liberal Arts, and
right.
as well as Professor of Religious Studies. And tell us what that Millennium Chair means.
Well, it was one of those endowed professorships that was given during a capital campaign to bring somebody new to the School of Liberal Arts. Traditionally, we were a sort of applied research university, but now, for the first time, our arts and sciences are the largest parts of IUPUI, so we're becoming more and more an arts and sciences campus, and my that endowed chair recognizes the kind of work that we want to be done on our campus in the liberal arts.
Ah, that explains why you left that southern part of heaven, Chapel Hill.
That's right. And I'm a Midwesterner. I'm from southern Illinois. I grew up in Mount Vernon, and it's great to be back close to home.
And you mentioned to me off the air that your parents still live in St. Louis, so you're
yes,
back here.
Yeah.
You mentioned in your book some other ties to Illinois. Of course, this program is heard in Indiana as well as Illinois and by internet all over the country and world. But you mentioned some very important things that happened here at the University of Illinois that we might just mention early on in the program before we ask for callers. The Muslim Student Association in this country was started at a meeting here at the University of Illinois. Was that back in the 60s, I think, your book tells us?
That's right, the early 60s. And, you know, there were Muslim groups around the country, student groups before then, but what happened was they came together to establish a national movement. And this was in part because there were now so many immigrant and actually more likely foreign students who were here just on student visas to study in the United States, oftentimes from the developing world, taking anybody who grew up in Illinois would be familiar with them or who went to college at Southern or University of Illinois and there to take engineering, medicine, et cetera. And so these students got together with students from all over the country, dozens of them, and established the Muslim Students Association at the University of Illinois. And there were chapters all over, including at, I can't help but mention, you know, Southern Illinois University, too.
Of course. And you have a photograph in your book of an early 60 group of the Muslim Student Association at Southern Illinois University.
And isn't that a great picture?
It is.
The president of the chapter was a white woman,
yes,
which entirely upsets notions about who these students were and what they were doing. And, I mean, it was Linda Clark. And, you know, really, if you weren't looking too closely, you would think it would, you know, she might also be a member of an SIU, sorority.
Of course.
No, indeed, she was president of the SIU chapter of the Muslim Students Association.
And the Islamic Society of North America, I think, may have gotten its organizational start in 93, also here at the University of Illinois. Do you know if that's the case?
It came out of the Muslim Student Association in 1981 here in Indianapolis, Indiana.
Ah, was it? Indiana.
Where the national headquarters for ISNA, or the Islamic Society of North America, is still located just a couple miles from me in Plainfield, where they have a modernistic red brick mosque center there. It's mostly not a mosque. It's an actual sort of office building.
I see. So that was 81.
Yeah, it's 81
in Indianapolis. Sorry, I had that confused.
No problem. And it's the largest Muslim organization in the United States in terms of dues-paying members.
Okay, I'm going to give out the phone numbers for people to call with comments or questions, but I'm going to probably not go to the first of those phone calls until after I give you a little chance to talk about some of the early representatives of Islam in this country. But when the time comes, the numbers are 333-9455 if you're in the 217 area code near Champaign-Urbana, where this program originates at WILL. If it's long distance, punch in 1-800-222-9455. If you would like to contact us by email, you may do that at will-talk@illinois.edu. So three ways to get your comments or questions for Professor Edward Curtis. Professor Curtis, you start off your book with some of these early, very early individuals who were Muslim, who may have, one you mentioned, who may have converted to Christianity, but you raise some major doubts about that because of some of yours and other research. When did the first mosques get started or communities of Muslims? That's fairly recently, isn't it?
Yeah, it depends on what you count as a mosque.
And we might explain why that's difficult to figure out.
That's right. I mean, on the one hand, a mosque refers to a building in the English language where people make their prayers. On the other hand, a mosque in Arabic is masjid. It simply means a place of prostration. And the Prophet Muhammad received a message that said, "I have made the whole world a mosque for you." So, based on this hadith, you could say that on this tradition.
A hadid is a teaching tradition.
Correct. That's right. That's right. The hadith are the sayings and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad that are collected in the first couple hundred years of Islam, and they form the basis of the sunnah, or the traditions of the Prophet Muhammad, which is the second holiest scripture in Islam. So the whole world, if you think of the whole world as a mosque in this tradition, then any time, any place and anywhere that Muslims started praying, this is a mosque. And what happened with slaves in particular is they didn't build any buildings, just like many Christians did not build church buildings, but they prayed in hush harbors. They prayed in the woods. And we have a documented instance of this in the early 1730s, where Job bin Salomon, an African Muslim slave who's brought to Maryland, prays on Kent Island. And he recorded, unfortunately, when he was trying to make his prayers, a kid kept throwing dirt on him, but he said he persevered. It was one of the reasons he really wanted to go home, which he did. He eventually did go home. In fact, he became quite a celebrity in England. He was such an educated person that James Oglethorpe, the founder of Georgia, found out about him and bought his bond, sent him to England. He went on a fundraising tour. The Duke of Montague helped to free him, and he even met the royal family and eventually went back to West Africa, courtesy of the British. But this guy, we know for certain that he started to pray in the woods in Maryland. That's a long answer to your question, but we know that that slaves continued to pray. We have many sort of documented instances of that. In terms of a building, the first building we can confirm that was specifically built by Muslims to be a mosque was in 1921 in Detroit, in the Highland Park neighborhood, right outside that Henry Ford plant where people could make $5 a day, and which attracted so many Arabic-speaking and Turkish-speaking Muslims, and which is still a center of Muslim America today and Arab America. And we know that in 21, they built and opened a mosque there.
And soon after, your book indicates there was one in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, of all places, in 1924.
That's right. They started renting a hall, the Rose of Fraternity Lodge, and then in the 30s, they built their own mosque, which is affectionately called the Mother Mosque of America.
All this information in Muslims in America, A Short History, published by Oxford University Press by Edward E. Curtis IV. Do you go by Ed or Edward, Eddie?
Edward, yeah, Edward. My dad's Ed.
Right. Okay.
Third, I'm the fourth. That's how we keep it straight.
Please call me Steve.
Okay. I'll do so.
Let me encourage listeners to give us a call again, 333-9455, 1-800-222-9455. Or if you'd like to email will-talk@illinois.edu. Your book is very helpfully arranged, I found, with fascinating illustrations, photographs, quotations, extended quotations from some of these source documents, which you or someone has translated from Arabic. I noticed you, from your CV, you've studied Arabic yourself. Were you interested in studying Islam very early in your career?
Yeah, it won't come as a shock, since you're calling me from an academic community, that it was a college class at Kenyon College, where I went to school, that influenced my decision to study Islam. At first, I was an 18-year-old, 17 turning 18-year-old freshman, and I took Vernon Schubel's Classical Islam. I read a fantastic book, Marshall Hodgson's Venture of Islam, and I was basically hooked after that. And after that, I started to study Arabic, and I then decided to do my school year abroad in Jerusalem and live with a Palestinian Arabic-speaking family there. And in graduate school, I decided to turn my focus toward Muslims in the United States.
Now, you went to WashU, Washington University in St. Louis, for a master's in history, and then on to the University of South Africa for your doctorate. How did you make those choices?
Yeah, well, I was studying with a fantastic African-Americanist at WashU. Her name was Nancy Grant. She had gone to UChicago. And And I also had a great team of Islamic studies scholars. Got my master's degree there, but unfortunately Professor Grant passed away at a very early age, and so I was left without anyone who was an expert in my field, and found one of those experts at the University of South Africa, a man, G.J.A. Lube, who had studied Muslim minorities, and he and a professor of religious studies at WashU became my international committee, and I wrote my dissertation under their guidance.
I noticed you've had a distinguished academic career from early on, that you were Phi Beta Kappa from Kenyon College, received several honors along the way, and you've published extensively elsewhere, of course, professional articles in peer-reviewed journals all over the place, and have been the editor of several books on Muslim American, African American history, Muslims in America, Short History, Columbia Source Book of Muslims in the United States. You've been an NEH fellow at the National Humanities Center. Throughout all this, is it an issue about whether you yourself are Muslim or not?
It's a great question. You know, it came up, I was doing a chat about this piece I wrote for the Washington Post on mosques in America, and someone asked me, and I'm going to get this slightly wrong, but could you please describe your association now or in the past with Islamic organizations in the United States or abroad? And boy, it sure felt like the HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee. You know, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Right.
And I think it's important that people be able to talk about religion in the public sphere and talk about it in a way that is, that we have the freedom to talk about who we are and not be punished for that. So I went ahead and answered that question. I gave my my religious vita. I told the person I was baptized Roman Catholic, confirmed Presbyterian Church USA, and in terms of my relationship with Islamic organizations, they could look that up in my CV because it's all there. I have no relationship to any Islamic organizations. But one of the reviews of my book even implies that I should have come ahead and said that I was a Muslim. One of the reviewers, a Boston political scientist, I think by the name of Peter Scarry, he said, I should go ahead and come clean about being a Muslim, or he implies this and says that the picture in my book of the Muslim American engineer, that's probably my wife. So there's I can't believe the academics would even engage in this kind of, this kind of investigation. I'm not sure what it is, but that woman who's pictured in the frontispiece of my book, she's not my wife. She's a Muslim American engineer who was helping build a hospital in Pakistan.
The question doesn't come up so much if you're a professor of chemistry.
Yeah. Now,
or if you're a professor of philosophy, well, are you yourself a a pragmatist or whatever? But in religion, it seems it sort of cuts both ways, and it's as if people, if you are Muslim, writing about Muslims, whether or not you're obviously prejudiced in their favor, and if you're a Christian or a Hindu or something else writing about Muslims, well, obviously you're prejudiced against them.
There's that. And I've gotten it from the other side too. Which I've gotten it from. Not most Muslims, but some Muslims who have said, well, you really don't have a right to write about Islam because you yourself are not Muslim, or that obviously explains why you haven't gotten the story right.
Yeah. We have our first caller on line number one. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for hosting this show, and also thank you for the author for writing on this topic. I'm a Muslim myself, and I haven't read your book yet, but it's in my plans to go ahead and have a look at it. But I just wanted to bring up a point about, you said that Muslims have been here for so long, but there's not really any, concrete contributions that Muslims may have made, say, in the 15th or the 16th century. You know, I'm sure now, there's, I don't know really exactly myself, but, architects, and they've contributed in a lot of ways recently that I know of. But, in the earlier days before independence, there really what contributions did Muslims make? And the when I was researching this myself, the only thing that I could come up with was the ice cream cone, and that was, I think, in the 20th century at the World Fair.
And that wasn't a Muslim. That was my great-great-grandfather, Ernest A. Hemway.
Oh, really?
From Southern Illinois, who popularized or was credited with popularizing an ice cream cone. He may have been Druze. We're not sure about his religious identification, but that was not a Sunni or a Shia Muslim, for sure.
Oh, I didn't know that. I just... Yeah. On Google, actually, it just says that he was a Muslim, too. And then it says another person's name, and I wasn't sure, because I always thought it was Hemway, but then it said somebody else's name, too. But anyway, so that's what I'm trying to say, that we don't really know of contributions that Muslims may have made, and I'm sure they're there. There must be if, you know, there's people here, but probably just more research needs to go into it.
Well, thank you so much for that.
Yes, thank you for the question.
A lot of research really has gone into it. I want to direct your attention to the Encyclopedia of Muslim American History, which was just released 2 months ago. Over 300 articles chronicling the contributions of Muslim Americans, both secular and religious, to the United States from the colonial era until present. And I think it's a really... it's a really important text, and so I'm so glad that you asked the question. It is all there. There are all kinds of contributions. Let me just mention military. Muslims served in the Revolutionary War. They served in the War of 1812. They served on both sides of the Civil War, both for the Union and the Confederacy. We have photographic evidence of this in the case of the Civil War. So we know that there were military contributions. One of the Muslims of the Revolutionary War was named Bampit Muhammad. Agriculture, incredible, especially in the South Carolina and Georgia coasts, around the sea coast, rice cultivation, indigo, other kinds of technologies that really the Europeans weren't very familiar with. They, along with their non-Muslim peers, brought that knowledge, and, you know, 30 or so thousand of them contributed to the making of the American economy before 1865, including some of George Washington's slaves who were Muslim, as you can learn about in the Encyclopedia of Muslim American History. Music. It's clear that Muslim American slaves were very much a part of that, part of making African American music, which is one of our great contributions to the world. And the list goes on and on. And immigrants, you mentioned the ice cream cone, which is a funny way of history meeting me, one of his heirs. But besides the ice cream cone, I mean, if you just look at the kinds of cultural contributions that Syrian, Arabic-speaking, Turkish immigrants made to the to the food culture, to the culture of labor in places like New York and Detroit, you know, over 100 years ago, I think then you can, you know, fully appreciate that Muslim immigrants and Muslim forced immigrants or slaves have been part of that American quilt of multiculturalism.
Thank you very much for the answer and the question. We have another caller waiting on line 4 from Bloomington, Indiana. Before I go to that call, let me just mention what some of the chapters are in your book. There are only 5. It's a brief book, 115 pages, plus index and other helps, chronologies and so forth. But you talk about the first Muslims in North America. You also talk about the first American converts to Islam. Then you talk about the Muslim immigrants, and then you talk about the greater religious awakening among Muslims in the late 20th century, and then finally a concluding chapter on Muslim response to 9/11. We'll get to some of those items soon, but let's do go to now the caller on line number 4 from Bloomington, Indiana. You're on the air.
Hi. I am troubled by Muslim protestations that we Americans, you know, should not fear Muslims when they come to America, because Muslims have a long history of being benign, you know, when they're a minority, but they're very intolerant as soon as they become a majority. Wherever Muslims are in the majority, they are repressive. They are intolerant. There is no Muslim majority country anywhere where any other religion is tolerated. You just try to start a Christian church in Saudi Arabia, and in Iraq, after our soldiers freed the Iraqis from Saddam Hussein, the Muslim majority attacked the small Christian community there in Iraq, burned their churches, killed some of their Christians. In Dearborn, Michigan, you mentioned Dearborn, Michigan, right here in America, there's a Muslim establishment, as you described. Well, these Muslims in Dearborn, Michigan, have become repressive. They have demanded concessions Christians would never demand and Christians could not get. And besides, there are some very intolerant parts of the Quran. You read the Quran, you'll find Surah 9 is full of repressive statements, but in the Quran, which advocate repression, even killing of non-Muslims. So why shouldn't Americans be alarmed when Muslims move in?
Let's let our guest respond.
Well, of course, Muslims have been here from before the United States, so they're already here. I'm sorry, he lost that battle. There are two members of the United States Congress, including Andre Carson, who lives just a couple miles north of you there in Bloomington, and Keith Ellison, who's from Minneapolis. They're African-American Muslims. So, they're here. They're not going anywhere. They are growing. Islam is a very attractive religion to many Americans, including there in Bloomington, Indiana, which is a very important site. I hope that the caller has had the chance to meet and talk with Muslims in Bloomington and will reach out. The call, frankly, makes me sad. I don't think you could say that about Jews or blacks or other groups who say basically, all 1.5 billion of them, whenever they're in the majority in a country, they're an intolerant people who hate Christians. I think that's a prime example of the kinds of challenges that Muslims and all Americans face right now. And I do hope that people of goodwill will continue to surround our Muslim neighbors and friends with love and compassion rather than racism and hate. There were a number of things in there, and I wonder what the gentleman would say to the parents of the Muslim Americans who have died for this country in Iraq. Are they also bad Muslims? If he would go to Arlington National Cemetery and see those crescents on the tombstones of James Ahern, the most decorated Muslim American soldier, a white man, by the way, in American history, would he say that about him? About Sultan Khan, who was eulogized by General Secretary of State Colin Powell, would he say that about him? So, but more than that, I don't think that Islam as a religion, and by the way, there are many secular Muslims, but is any more intolerant than any other major world religions, certainly not in the text. If the gentleman is a Christian or a Jew, he knows the intolerant parts of our scriptures, including when Joshua is commanded in the Old Testament to go kill every man, woman, and child who's not a Jew. Now, we interpret our scriptures. I'm not sure why Muslims aren't allowed to interpret theirs. So we have a lot of experts on Islam in America, it seems, people who read 19th-century translations of the Quran and decide that they know what it means without, of course, being able to understand it in the original Arabic or bothering to look up the 1,400-year tradition of commentary on the Quran. Why don't they actually go ask a Muslim whether they, a real live person, whether they actually believe this stuff? I think they'll find that they interpret their scriptures. So, and finally, I invite the gentleman to travel to most Muslim majority countries and visit churches there: Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt. This is not to say that Christian minorities don't have a hard time in these countries, but churches sit right next to mosques, and there is a story that is not told in the press about cooperation as well as conflict. So it's a complicated picture that has little to do sometimes with the religion of Islam and much more to do with the post-colonial situation and political and economic battles going on in these countries. That was a whole bag full of various anti- or Islamophobic kind of rhetoric, but it's very much a part of our contemporary moment, and it's one of the reasons why, you know, I'm having trouble getting my message out, you know, about Muslims being in the country from the very beginning and always being a part of the American experiment.
I was thinking, as our caller and you were making those points of the account in the Christian Gospels about Jesus using a whip to drive people out of a temple, it sounds like an early religious conflict that involved violence. But I needed to try to be sort of neutral here. Let's go to another caller, this time in line one, Urbana. Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes.
I'll start by saying that I am not a Muslim. Some would say I'm not a Christian. But anyway, I think you did an excellent job of refuting the bigot of Bloomington, who calls the station quite frequently with the same venomous statements. But may I briefly state some of the history and some of the contemporary facts?
Do be brief if you can. We have several callers waiting.
As brief as I can be.
Thanks.
There has been a Christian minority in Egypt and another in Lebanon, and particularly in Lebanon, they have been treated much better than minorities, even Christian minorities, have been in Europe for most of the history of this matter. Historically, there has been a Christian and a Jewish minority throughout most of the Middle East, and they were treated generally much better than minorities were treated in Europe. I think there's very little use in trying to refute these venomous statements, because the people have a mindset and they just will not listen to fact.
Well, thank you very much for making that observation. Let's go on to another caller on line number two. This is from Champaign. Yes, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I also have a response to the caller from Bloomington. He's already been answered in terms of there is history or there are experiences in other countries that, you know, would seem to contradict some of the assertions that he made, or at least offer an alternative to some of the assertions he made. But the point I would like to make is we don't even have to do that, because even in the worst-case scenario in his imagination, say that for some reason there were to be an increase in, for some reason, intolerant and violent Muslims, I don't think that would really happen. But say in his mind he thinks that's going to happen, it's not as if our laws and our constitutional protections in this country are suddenly going to stop working. If people are indeed committing violence, the law will take care of them, just as it takes care of Christian lawbreakers and Jewish lawbreakers and Hindu lawbreakers. We have a constitution that protects religious freedom, including the freedom of worship of Christians and Jews and Islam, and Islam and any other religion. And so, when people point at, you know, in Saudi Arabia they don't allow a church to be built. Well, of course, because that's a theocracy. It's not the United States, and they don't have the constitution that the United States has that guarantees us freedom of religion and freedom of worship. So I would just like to counsel, please do rely on our laws, our rights, and our constitutional protections. I don't see those going away in the near future.
Yeah, I really appreciate the callers. And in fact, if the caller and others will look at the statements of the two Muslim congressmen in the House, you'll see wonderful statements about how those American values enshrined in the Constitution
are, in their view, also Islamic values. This is a theme that you see over and over again, especially among Muslim immigrants in the 1950s, and then, you know, in the 1970s and onward, African-American Muslims, Muslim practitioners, the idea that American values are Islamic values. And in fact, African-American Muslims have played an extraordinarily important role in guaranteeing the constitutional freedom to practice your religion. It was Nation of Islam members whose cases, especially Cooper v. Pate, for example, in the 60s, began to expand the practice of various religions in U.S. prisons, and which then guaranteed religious freedom for incarcerated people held in both federal and state jails and prisons all over the country. So we see that Muslims, both indigenous and immigrant, are really, you know, fond and love the Constitution and consider it a great privilege overall to be living in a country that is bound by those laws and that is governed by the rule of law. And that's just not the picture that, you know, you get sometimes when you turn on Fox News or other outlets, or even NPR, which tends to report cases of domestic terror oftentimes more than the cases of when Muslims have a conference to celebrate the Constitution, for example. That doesn't make much news.
We're talking on Focus today with Edward Curtis, professor of religion in Indianapolis, about his new book, Muslims in America, A Short History, published by Oxford University Press. I'm sorry it doesn't come with a study guide. I know Oxford doesn't do that, but perhaps people will find valuable this interview along with the book if they want to use this book in group settings to discuss and learn about Islam's history in America. We have several callers waiting. I'd like to talk about the chapter and sections you have on Muslim feminists, which I found wonderful, but we do have callers, so let's go to line number three, Gibson City. You're on the air.
Oh, yes. Hello. And first of all, I want to thank you for your book. And I do want to talk about this fear of Islam, and I think that's not just something new. I think our country is giving us fear of just about everything, but now it's Muslims. And as a person who has worked in the West Bank, and particularly in Hebron, and working with Muslim people in nonviolent work and human rights documentation, I found the Muslim people very welcoming and very warm and very inviting. And I think that that's what we got to do as human beings is look at each other. And somebody may be different, but get to know them. And I also want to say that I've been invited to the mosque in Champaign-Urbana, and I've had wonderful dialogue and have met some wonderful Muslim people. And I think that's where we got to start. And the only other thing I want to say is that I was reading up on this Ground Zero with the Cordoba House, and I just, I guess, reading and educating yourself, I found out that Cordoba House was a place in Spain, and that the Muslims were ruling, and they were very generous in letting people put up their churches and synagogues at that time. So, I mean, we got to look back on what we did with the crusade. So our Christian history isn't always the best either. And as a Christian, I believe that we got our biggest gift to each other is love, and that's what Jesus has taught us. And I'll hang up and I'll just say thank you and keep on doing what you're doing. I think you're doing a good job of educating us. I hope to read your book. And I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you so much. I just want to thank you for that call and your kind words. And I think, you know, that when we look back at the history, especially the pre-modern world, I mean, almost all of us are going to find things, whether it's a Christian culture or a Muslim culture, that we find at the least distasteful and probably more than distasteful. of course, the world was very, very different then. But I appreciate, what we need is a sober view of history that is complex. And I think in the case of, you know, what this little book tries to do is to say, is to weave Muslims back into an American history that they helped to create, but that for which they're not generally acknowledged, so that we can stop talking about Muslims over there and start understanding Islam by getting to know our Muslim neighbors and friends and coworkers.
Another caller on line number one in Champaign. Yes, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, line one.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much for your contribution to educating all of us with regard to Islam in America. That's an incredibly important topic in my view. I just wanted to turn briefly to this question of that you've referred to a bit, is the question of the media and the problem in the media that one could never speak about African Americans or Jews and so forth in the way that it is permitted, essentially, in the media and in public discourse with regards to Muslims. And I found it very shocking that, I know that you mentioned NPR, but if you take, for example, not just Fox News, but a whole arena of outlets, including our local newspaper here, you have figures like Cal Thomas and Nat Hentoff and others who are just commonly writing blatantly Islamophobic articles, commentaries, and so forth. One online that didn't appear in our local newspaper by Cal Thomas was entitled Purging Evil. And he wanted the government to require Muslim clerics, as in apparently in Syria as of this past year, to submit their sermons to the government for observation to prevent so-called, you know, Islamic extremists from taking over our country or whatever the fear may be in his part. It's very disturbing. And finally, I just wanted to note that and see what you'd say in this regard. What I find so shocking is that you have one of the two major political parties that, as a matter of course, is using anti-Islamic rhetoric to support its quote-unquote political ends, and I found it very sad, and I'm wondering what you have to say with regard to how we might undercut that kind of effort, call it into question, and raise the level of public discourse.
Thank you for the question.
Well, I'm going to point to a WILL program, I think, last week with Ubu Patel, who is the director and founder of the Interfaith Youth Corps. I think there are all kinds of great ideas on how to undercut prejudice if you go back and here's a plug for you, Steve. If you go back and listen to that that great program again, which I had the pleasure of listening to driving across Illinois last week. So there are some ideas. The caller's quite right. After 9/11, President George W. Bush, the leader of the Republican Party, went to a mosque and cautioned fellow Americans about abusing, discriminating against, insulting Muslim Americans. And he said that was not America, that was not the best values of America. Unfortunately, some Republican politicians, including Palin, Gingrich, gubernatorial candidate Lazio, and Peter King, have decided that they're going to use this issue as an election year issue and play to people's fears and hatreds rather than calling on the best of American values as George W. Bush did after 9/11.
We're quickly running out of time, but we're going to try to squeeze in one more call. If it's short, line two. Yes, you're on the air.
Hi. Michael Krzyzewski, who's a sex career student, is teaching a class on Islam for Methodists at our church. I'm looking forward to reading your book. I think it'll be very informative. And he did say the correct pronunciation for Muslim is Muslim. Okay? Thanks. Bye.
Thank you. I often say it the other way. What do you think about that, Professor Curtis?
Well, in Arabic, which is, of course, a minority language in the Muslim world, it's definitely Muslim. And most American Muslims are now saying Muslim. So Muslim, that was popular in the 60s and the 70s. And if somebody wants to pronounce it that way, I think that's fine, no problem. But most American Muslims are saying either Muslim or Muslim.
in our last 2 minutes, something about Muslim feminists. You give a great example in your book.
Absolutely. I mean, Muslim women, American Muslim women, and Muslim women abroad have been, since the dawn of the modern age, looking to Islamic tradition as a way to combat patriarchy and sexism. Most practicing Muslim American women and Muslim women abroad believe deeply that the answer to sexism and patriarchy is not is inside Islam. They don't need to leave Islam. What they need to do is become educated in what the Quran and the Sunnah say, the traditions of the Prophet Muhammad and the Quran, the Holy Book, and to use those truths to combat the discrimination that they face in their communities. How they do that, what techniques they use, they disagree about. How far to go, they disagree about that. But it's really clear that both now and in the past that African-American women in particular show how much American women who have converted to Islam think that Islam is a tradition that brings them dignity and equality as women.
And let's fill in a note, one more minute with the organized Islamic response to acts of terror that you have your last chapter about.
That's right. I mean, I guess I sort of understand why, Muslims preaching peace didn't make headlines. But, I mean, Muslims spent hours and hours and hours responding to 9/11 and condemning terror. And they did so and this is all outlined in the book, so I'm not going to go over all of it. But finally, a few years after 9/11, the Fiqh Council of North America, this is sort of the Islamic Law Council, once again they issued an authoritative fatwa or religious opinion, which was signed by every major Muslim organization in the United States and over 300 mosques, saying that they condemn in absolute terms terrorism, that it's un-Islamic, and that, you know, they condemn what happened in 9/11. They did that right after 9/11 as well. It didn't come late. It's just that for some reason people didn't notice. And maybe that's because in the end, you know, over a third of Americans have never met a Muslim. So if you haven't met a Muslim, you're not likely to know about the Muslim condemnation of terrorism.
My thanks to Professor Edward Curtis, author of Muslims in America, A Short History, published by Oxford University Press, one of the top 100 books of last year by Publishers Weekly. I'm Steve Shoemaker, a guest host today for Focus.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Many of our past shows, along with local news features, are available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. At this point, we'll take our usual break for news, and then Focus will continue, so please stay tuned.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana. WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2012 lecture series presents Finding Where We Are, Critical Spatial Thinking, and the Future of Geographic Information by Michael Goodchild on Thursday, October 13th at Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey. We're at mid-session. Corn has bounced off its lows and actually has traded in positive territory today. We'll get to that in just a second. First, though, from Canadian Finance Minister Joe Flaherty, he is saying that the Greek debt crisis is getting worse rather than better, and he's urging European leaders to take clear and decisive action to avoid a banking meltdown. He says that the whole world could be affected if there were a bank meltdown, a credit crunch coming out of Europe. He's calling it a serious situation and that it has been serious for some time and that it is getting worse, Flaherty says, because of the continued uncertainty. He says that Canadian officials are frustrated and they want to impress on the European Union and European leaders that this is an extraordinary time and you can't follow normal procedures relative to solving debt crises. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. And as we do that, we see that in Kansas City, December wheat down 5 1/4 at 698 3/4, while the May is down 4 1/2 at 723. December wheat at the Board of Trade, 615 1/2 up 6 1/4. March, 652 up 5 1/2. In May, at 675 up 6 1/2. December corn, 595 up 2 1/2. March, 608 1/4. Now 3/4.